The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Well, thanks for coming to Socialism again this year and coming to the Spanish Civil War talk. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. Unfortunately, just to start with the end, it doesn't end well. And it never does. So, but I think there's so much to learn and so much to talk about. I won't be able to touch on everything. I'm sure everybody's got the one thing they want to talk about. And if I don't get to that, please feel free to bring it up in discussion. That's my introduction, so I will go ahead and start. After months of preparation, on July 17, 1936, Spain's military elite, supported by large landowners, the Catholic Church, the Spanish and much of the Basque and Catalan bourgeoisies, monarchists of various and often competing stripes, and avowed fascists, rebelled against the liberal Republican government, which had won elections in February, 4 months earlier, proving that Spain's particular concoction of masters of disaster felt no compunction about their conspiracy whatsoever, and of course no commitment to the democratic process when the elections did not go their way. It is useful to talk about the anatomy of a traditional military insurrection in Spain, developed with much practice throughout much of the middle of the 19th century. Apart from its last colonies in North Africa, where the 1936 coup actually began, Spain's military was largely organized with one object in mind, controlling Spanish workers. Hence, the bulk of Spain's military was stationed in barracks in all of its major cities. For its part, the countryside was policed by the highly militarized regiment of the hated civil guards, the Guardia Civil. In many ways, the military and the Guardia Civil were two sides of the same coin, often working in concert. Another characteristic of the Spanish military, again since the 19th century, was their attitude of super-enfranchised arbiters of the national good. That is, they believed they had the inalienable right to be the ultimate overseers of the political process. If they weren't happy with the direction of Spanish politics, they believed it was always their prerogative to intervene forcefully if necessary. In the event of such an intervention, or pronunciamiento, as the Spanish call their military coups, officers would lead their troops stationed in the barracks of each city into the streets, arrest representatives of government, and announce the formation of a military government that would usurp all existing civil powers. Such success or failure of a pronunciamiento was rested on the collective, though individual, decisions of each officer to lead his troops out of the barracks and on whether his troops followed. Since failure to act could mean summary execution if the coup was successful, or vice versa if it wasn't successful, participation in the attempted coup could also lead to execution. In other words, officers had to be mighty confident of the pronunciamiento's overall success before they would be willing to risk action. One can imagine all the officers calling their fellow officer buddies in other barracks across the country, nervously consulting and gauging everybody else's state of mind, like children on the eve of the first day of class. What are you going to wear? Are you going to rebel? Yikes, I don't know, should I? You can sort of imagine, that's probably a stupid thing to try to put humor in at that point, but anyway. Hence, a pronunciamiento's success or failure depended on a constellation of factors, the balance of physical forces, the number of troops supporting or opposing the coup, as well as psychological, both on the part of the officers as well as the sitting government forced to respond to the coup. Since everything would happen in a matter of hours, sometimes stretched out over a night or a full day, total elapsed time and timing were critical factors determining a coup's success or failure. Understanding the intensity of the moment, the confluence of psychological and physical actions and reactions, is necessary to grasp the importance of the reactions to the coup in July 1936. The contrasting responses to the generals says much about the contending forces who oppose the military rebellion. First, we should look at the response of Spain's Popular Front government, which was criminal, but not terribly surprising, since the ultimate power of the state over the masses is its monopoly of physical force, the police and the military. A military revolt leaves the state with a serious problem. And I probably don't need to explain that too much in this crowd. By all accounts, the Popular Front officials responded with predictable passivity, paralyzed in the face of its own armed wing rebelling against it, but significantly afraid to make a call to arms to its own citizenry, the organized working class, who it feared even more than the generals. ostrich-like in the face of danger, when time was of the essence, the Republicans called for normalcy and tranquility from Spanish citizens during the entire day following the beginning of the revolt. Incidentally, just to get a little ahead of myself, the Spanish Communist Party paper Mundo Obrero and Socialist Party leaders aped the Popular Front government in their calls for tranquility. Even worse, during those fantastically critical hours, while the officers were calling each other and consulting over their attire, whether or not to go out in insurrection, the Popular Front government attempted to negotiate with the generals, enticing them to call off the dogs with officers with offers of cabinet ministries or cabinet positions. But like the good fascists they were, they refused the government offers, opting instead to go for the whole hog. From the very beginning, the Republicans showed that they were more terrified of the Spanish working class than they were of fascist military officers. I'll say more about this, speaking about it not just in terms of fear, but as a direct manifestation of the politics of the Popular Front government. The other response, and in sharp contrast to the Republicans, was that of the Spanish workers. The trade unions and radical elements of the parties of the left, meaning not necessarily their leaders, recognizing the seriousness of the rebellion, acted decisively, but not necessarily, as is often portrayed, spontaneously, because Spanish and Catalan workers had known for a long time that a violent confrontation was likely. Workers demanded that the government release arms to them. Their requests were denied over and over until it was almost too late. Organized by their unions and cadre of the anarchist and socialist organizations, workers surrounded the soldiers' barracks in places where the soldiers were still there, or took to the streets where soldiers had already joined the uprising, raised barricades to stop their advance. Spanish and Catalan workers knew a lot about building barricades. With every victory, workers gained more arms, confiscating them from the vanquished, and more confidence in their ability to trounce the fascists, and they gained more strength against the fascists, but also against the passive Popular Front Republicans. One thing led to another, as they say, and the fight against the uprising led over the next days and weeks to a profound social revolution, going furthest in Catalonia and Aragon, based on factory takeovers, committees of defense patrolling the streets, massive collectivization in different and varied forms on the land, and the formation of militias to take the fight from the cities to the villages and stop the advance of fascist troops in the countryside. Fundamental to the dynamic of this revolution was the need for workers to respond to the imperatives of war, raising an army, building or converting industry for the production of arms, and feeding the populace as well as the volunteer troops, or militias as they were called. Workers responded with lightning speed and in sharp contrast to the Republican government, a defensive bulwark against fascism such as had not yet been seen in 1930s Europe. Remember, fascism by this time had already risen to power in Germany, Austria, Italy, and neighboring Portugal. But Spanish workers were interested in more than simply defending themselves from fascism. They were also taking the moment that the crisis of capitalism was providing to build the long-awaited libertarian communist society, or what most of us in this room would call socialism. Everybody's heard of George Orwell, famous description from his book Homage to Catalonia offers a taste of the enthusiasm he saw when he first got to Barcelona. How many people have read Orwell, Homage to Catalonia? Okay. The quote that I have here is too long. If you get tired, throw stuff. But it's really, I think, good to get his, and even though it was a little bit late in the day, December of 1936 as opposed to July and August, where I am at right now, it gives us a taste. It was the first time that I'd ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags or with the red and black flags of the anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with a hammer and sickle and the initials of the revolutionary parties. Almost every church had been gutted and its images burnt. Churches here and there were being systematically demolished by gangs of workmen. Every shop and cafe had an inscription that it had been collectivized. Even the bootblacks had been collectivized and their boxes painted red and black. Waiters and shop walkers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. There were no private motor cars. They had all been commandeered, and all the trams and taxis and much of the other transport were painted red and black. The revolutionary posters were everywhere, flaming from the walls in clean reds and blues that made the few remaining advertisements look like daubs of mud. down the Ramblas, the wide central artery of the town, where crowds of people streamed constantly to and fro, the loudspeakers were bellowing revolutionary songs all day and far into the night. And it was the aspect of the crowds that was the queerest thing of all. In outward appearance, it was a town in which the wealthy classes had practically ceased to exist. Practically everyone wore rough working class clothes or blue overalls or some variant of the militia uniform. All this was queer and moving. There was much in it that I did not understand. In some ways, I did not even like it, but I recognized it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. How is it that millions of workers in 1930s Spain were dreaming of building a social society, you might ask? Like much of the world, I'm going to now step back and talk a little bit about primarily the 1930s to give a sense of where this all comes from. Like much of the world economy in the 1930s, Spain's was tattered and torn. Decades of corrupt alternation in power of the Conservative Party, which represented Spain's filthy rich, and the Liberal Party, which represented Spain's filthy rich, had failed to modernize Spain's political system. In fact, it left power concentrated in the hands of the most reactionary and nasty elements of ruling class society. Spanish workers lived and worked in some of the most miserable conditions in Europe. Anthony Beaver described the circumstances common to agricultural workers, braceros, in two of the largest growing regions, Andalusia and Extremadura. Most of the landless braceros had never tasted meat and lived in adobe huts with a hole for a window. On occasions, these day laborers would try to move into the newly built pigsties because the accommodation for animals was so much better. The braceros earned in the region of 3 pesetas a day if he was lucky enough to be chosen for work. The leader of the fascist-style Falange, José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the son of the previous dictator, cites women working a 9-hour day for 1 peseta. Many were often prepared to work just for a bowl of soup and some bread. The right-wing Catholic paper El Debate admitted that around Ciudad Real, the peasants were eating grass to stay alive. Conditions for city workers was only marginally better. In his acclaimed autobiography, The Forging of a Rebel, Spanish author and trade unionist Arturo Barea writes about his co-worker in an office with years of experience and seniority, living in a below-ground urban hovel, earning full-time wages that weren't enough to keep his son, also a wage earner, from starving to death. Starvation wages for Madrid office workers was the norm. I hated that terrible, hidden, shame-faced hunger of the office workers, which then ruled so many homes in Madrid. It wasn't only urban and farm workers who had been cut out of the system, but virtually the entire middle class of the so-called liberal professions, or the educated elite, doctors, lawyers, teachers, shop owners, etc. The filthy rich of Spain had profited massively through neutrality during World War II, selling junk to both sides, sparking galloping inflation. However, with intense and violent repression of workers' organizations the norm, in the economic downturn that followed the war, the rising cost of living was not matched by a rise in workers' wages. Like much of Europe, Spain experienced a revolutionary period in the aftermath of the war that was violently repressed by police and hired thugs. Ultimately, though, in order to impose calm, and I say calm in quotes because that's their calm and not ours, Spain's ruling class resorted to a military dictatorship in the 1920s that lasted until 1931, when the dictatorship fell in the face of a rising tide of middle class and working class militancy. Due to the pressure from below, and perhaps seeing no alternative, Spain's ruling oligarchy opted or was forced to accept a democracy, what is known as Spain's Second Republic. At least some thought that co-opting a broader range of middle-class elements, political professionals, might be useful for staving off the demands of one of Europe's most radical and militant workers' movements. Hence, following the advice of the highest-ranking nobles, King Alfonso XIII fled Spain, and the Republic was declared on April 14, 1931, after Republicans had won municipal elections in all the major cities. There's a story behind why cities and not the countryside, but we can talk about that later if you want. In his famous book on the revolution in Spain, written as events were unfolding, Felix Moro, an American Trotskyist, explains that there were 5 major stumbling blocks that the Republic would have to hurdle if it had any chance at success. The stranglehold of the Catholic Church in many spheres, cultural, economic, education, etc. The yucky army, top-heavy and costly, and a constant source of conspiracy. The national and regional questions, centralization versus autonomy or separatism, including the situation in North Africa, not just the Basque Country in Catalonia. The urban and industrial economy, and land distribution to peasants and modernization of agriculture. During the years of the Second Republic, three social forces would contend for the right to sort out these problems to their own liking. First, of course, there was a traditional ruling class oligarchy consisting of a complicated mishmash of militant Catholics, monarchists organized around opposing claims to the throne, a military that had coddled for over a century both liberal revolutionaries as well as the most dastardly reactionaries, an industrial, financial, and mining-based bourgeoisie that was divided into regions with some aspirations of autonomy, less than their middle-class counterparts. Catalan industrialists, for example, knew the use of the Spanish military could be good for them. With so many different elements making up the Spanish ruling class, often competing elements, it should come as no great surprise that organized reaction to the challenges of republican democracy in the first year of the Second Republic did not coalesce easily or immediately for a ruling class that was unaccustomed to being questioned, much less needing actual political parties to defend its privilege. The second social force in Spain was the organized and super militant working class. The Spanish left was dominated by two trade union blocs, the CNT, or the National Confederation of Labor, led by the anarchists, and the Socialist Party led UGT, UGT, General Union of Workers. Both trade unions were internally diverse, even divided between reformists and revolutionaries. Generally speaking, the CNT was considered more revolutionary and the socialist more reformist. However, something that is frequently underestimated by writers is that in the fast-paced political climate of the 1930s, politics were profoundly fluid, especially at the rank and file level, with a working class that radicalized significantly during the years of the Republic. Just as an example, to challenge the CNT strength in the fields of southern Spain, the socialist UGT union formed in 1930 the FNTT, the National Federation of Land Workers. It was so successful that by 1936 it numbered 500,000 land laborers, mostly young, mostly decidedly revolutionary, and were a huge source of pressure for the Socialist Party lean to the left. Additionally, there was a Spanish Communist Party that was meager in comparison to the Socialist Party and anarchists, with just a few thousand members by most accounts. Significantly, in Spain, there was a relatively large communist movement outside or in opposition to the international communist movement dominated by the decades of the 30s by counter-revolutionary Stalinism. In fact, the anti-Stalinist communist movement was larger than the official communist movement in Spain. The most important of these oppositionists came together in 1935 to form the PUM, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, explicitly anti-Stalinist, though not Trotskyist. The PUM was strongest in Catalonia, but much smaller than the anarchists, who they attempted to orient to, but ultimately ended up tailing. That's sort of putting some of the later story now, but I'm not going to be able to talk very much about the PUM. The bureaucracy of the Spanish Socialist Party and the almost mirror bureaucracy of the trade union, of their trade union, the UGT, was divided between the right-wing reformists associated with Indalecio Prieto and the left-wing reformists who followed Francisco Largo Caballero, sometimes known as the Spanish Lenin, largely ironically and in part because the Spanish Communist Party found it useful to flatter him in order to manipulate him. As the face of the left wing of socialism, Largo Caballero was massively popular among the younger radicals of the Socialist Party who were drawing revolutionary conclusions to the crisis in the 1930s. Largo Caballero responded in kind by adopting ever more radical rhetoric, though he failed to match his increasingly radical rhetoric with practice. It should be mentioned that Largo Caballero's past was checkered at best. His almost fanatical obsession with building the UGT at the expense of the anarchists led him to collaborate with the previous dictator in the 1920s, even as the anarchists were outlawed and persecuted. The Spanish anarchists were the strongest and largest anarchist movement in the world by far. Like the socialists, they had a history of divisions within their ranks. Most recently, in the early years of the Republic, a group of 30 influential cadre, the so-called Treintistas, the thirtieths or something like that, signed a manifesto declaring their opposition to the CNT's apoliticism, the CNT's often ultra-left abstention from politics, seeing any participation as offering legitimacy to bourgeois politics. The Trentistas also critiqued other aspects of traditional CNT strategy and tactics. They were overtly reformist in their estimation of the possibilities for social transformation in 1930s Spain. Meanwhile, the majority of the CNT identified with the small affinity group, the FAI, Anarchist Federation of Iberia, Iberia being the peninsula that Spain and Portugal are on. Some anarchists have compared the FAI to a revolutionary cadre that worked inside the larger and broader base union consisting of revolutionary and non-revolutionary workers alike. Lots of anarchists would bristle at the notion of the FAI being described as cadre. But I think it's a good description in a lot of ways. The anarchists were famous for their daring and bravery and, frankly, their suicidal volunteerism, declaring libertarian communism in isolated places and occasions that left them weak and vulnerable vis-a-vis the repressive state. On numerous occasions, Casas Viejas in 1933 being the most famous, they were crushed mercilessly without having successfully sparked the general strike that would lead to the revolution and the quote-unquote disappearance of the state. Such voluntarism, or as some called it, revolutionary gymnastics, ultimately proved exhausting and demoralizing. These are the tactics that contributed to the reformism of the Trentistas and opposition even within the FAI and the broader CNT themselves. Finally, it probably goes without saying, on principle, the anarchists were, it finally goes without saying, on principle, the anarchists were professed anti-authoritarian, opposed to the capitalist state, but also against any manifestation of state power, no matter what social class controlled that state. Not surprisingly, they were vague about the general strike, how the general strike would lead to revolution and the disappearance of the state, and even more so, how libertarian communism could be consolidated against its enemies. They soundly oppose any notion of creating a dictatorship of the proletariat. One further thing to say about the anarchists that as revolutionaries today, we should not underestimate, and this applies to some degree to the socialists as well. Whatever their shortcomings, the anarchists were able to become deeply ingrained in working class culture. In lots of ways, their success reflected directly the long-standing nastiness of the Spanish state. Education was controlled and stifled through the Spanish Catholic Church, so the anarchists became forerunners in experimentations of education reform, offering secularized schooling for children, but also for adult workers in their myriad clubs, offering all kinds of classes on every imaginable subject, evolution, sexuality, free love, revolution, women's liberation, ecology, economics, basket weaving, you name it. I invented the last one, just like we're doing this weekend. You name it, the anarchists debated it naturally from a perspective diametrically opposed to the official catechisms of the Catholic Church. Social welfare outside the Catholic Church was non-existent, so the anarchists organized it. Leisure activities, picnics, hiking excursions, theater, all organized by the anarchists. One testimonial speaks of the thousands that would gather to take all manners of public transport en masse from Barcelona into the countryside each Sunday to picnic, hike, and debate politics all day long. Anarchist culture thoroughly penetrated working class Spain, rural and urban. Finally, the third force that would challenge for power during the years of the Second Republic were the parties of the genuine reform-minded Republicans, representing Spain's small middle class. Though their parties were tiny, minuscule even, on two out of three occasions, they were able to win national elections. On both occasions, they outpolled the political right because they were able to gain the votes of the massive workers' organizations. Looking at the three national elections, from the victory of the Republic in 1931 to the election of the Popular Front in February of 1936, can give a hint of the political dynamic that defines the Republic from its birth until the military rebellion in 1936. Progressive Republicans won elections in 1931 for two reasons. One, Spain's ruling class was unprepared for the messy process of party building and parliamentary democracy, especially considering all of its own internal divisions. I've already explained that. Two, the second reason that the left Republican parties won was their alliance with the Spanish Socialist Party, by far the largest political party, and its union, along with additional votes they gained from anarchists who were breaking from the apolitical stance of not participating in elections. Upon winning elections against Spain's disorganized right, the left Republicans attempted to address some of the problems Moro wrote about and I mentioned earlier, of course, always from the perspective of their own class interest. They attempted to implement moderate reforms on the land, secularize education, modernize the military and make some concessions to the regional aspirations of Catalonia, though not the Basque Country. Workers protested and struck, both on principle, because they refused to support a bourgeois government and hoped to spark a revolution in the case of the anarchists, but also because they found the reforms too timid. General strikes in 1931, 32, and 33 were all repressed violently by the left Republican government. Any and every attempt to take matters into their own hands met with violent repression and jail sentences, victimized by the very liberal social democrats who they had voted into office. Moreover, workers learned that even the Republicans' moderate measures, specifically those aimed at land reform, were consistently blocked because of entrenched caciquismo. Caciquismo being the old system of political bosses that ruled the small towns and countryside on behalf of the large landowners, and which the Republicans couldn't do away with by simply winning elections. To add insult to injury, from the perspective of the Spanish workers, the perpetrators of a military coup that failed in 1932 were treated with kid gloves by the liberal government, an error that would cost the Republicans dearly 4 years later, as the Civil Guard General José Sanjurjo, who organized that first coup, was also one of the important leaders of the second coup that began the Civil War. Spain's ruling class, though unable to scramble fast enough to win those first elections in 1931, proved sufficiently powerful on the ground to forestall most attempts at reform. In 1933, the disparate institutions, clubs, and organizations of the ruling class came together under the leadership of José María Gil Robles to form the CEDA. The CEDA was the Spanish Confederation of Autonomous Right, the Autonomous Right, plural, because of all these groups coming together. Effectively, a political party built as the alliance of most of the forces of the Spanish right, it essentially becomes a fascist party in my estimation, though that is not the prevailing view of contemporary academics. More importantly, it was the prevailing view of Spain's working class in the 1930s, who were much more astute than contemporary academics regarding the niceties of defining fascism, in my opinion. In 1933, disillusion with the Republicans pushed the anarchist CNT to renew their traditional apolitical boycott of elections, apolitical in the sense that they don't want to participate in politics. Furthermore, a radicalization of rank-and-file socialists, a story I won't tell here, but many of them, like those of the FNTT, new to the movement and younger, pushed the Socialist Party to run their candidates unaligned with the Republicans, an important contrast to their practice of running candidates with the Republicans as they had done in 1931. Left alone, the small left Republicans were defeated by the increasingly unified Spanish right. Gil Robles' CEDA was the party that gained the most votes, or the most seats. The victory of the CEDA led to 2 years of rollbacks of even the modest reforms, and led as well even more to even more political repression. Workers came to call these years the Bienio Negro, or the Black Biennium. The most important event during this period was the general strike called by the socialists to protest Niceto Alcalá Zamora, the president of the republic, appointing CEDA ministers to his cabinet in 1934. In spite of the president being identified with more conservative elements of republicanism, he had delayed naming ministers to his cabinet from the Theta because he didn't trust them. He took seriously their proclamations alluding to their hope to follow the example of others, like the Nazis, of simply using the electoral process to take power. Many Spanish workers may have been illiterate, but they had seen the growth of fascist parties across Europe, rising through legal maneuvers. Spanish workers vowed to not let the same thing happen in Spain, and a general strike was their weapon to block the appointments. However, workers threatening a total all-out general strike with an overtly political demand and reformist labor leaders actually willing to prepare for it proved to be two different things. Lack of real preparation led to a rapid defeat on most of the peninsula, and the arrest of labor leaders and Republicans alike, along with the entire regional Catalan government who had used the occasion to declare independence. The defeat exposed the growing gap between rank-and-file radicalization and organizational conservatism, as well as significant sectarianism on the part of the socialists and to some degree the anarchists as well. However, in the northern mining province of Asturias, where there was greater willingness among the workers' organizations to act in unison, the strike turned almost immediately into a revolutionary insurrection that only went down in defeat after 2 weeks of all-out military assault. Thousands of surrendering workers were executed. Tens of thousands were jailed. Significantly, General Francisco Franco, famous in Spain's wars in the 1920s in North Africa for his brutality, was brought in to crush the miners with his crack Foreign Legion troops. 15 months later, there would be new elections, once again prompted by Alcalá, the president's refusal to give power to the Theta. Hatred toward the political reactionaries like the Theta and their fake republicanism, as well as the rallying cry for the Asturian political prisoners, convinced Spanish workers to vote the reactionaries out of office. Their reconstituted left alliance was called the Popular Front, led, as was the case in 1931, by the small parties of the left Republicans, but endorsed by most of the workers' parties and organizations, with the hugely significant deciding factor, probably, of the anarchist vote, basically not telling people to not vote. Just a brief explanation of the politics of the Popular Front. In Spain, it seemed common sense for many to make an attempt to ally forces on the left to confront the growing threat. That's 30 minutes. Okay, where am I? To confront the growing threat of fascism, and multiple attempts had been made to this effect in the union movement, but with little success. There was a long history of intense political and organizational competition between the socialists and the anarchists and the unions they dominated. Lots of not nasty stuff I won't get into. However, with the rise of fascism elsewhere and with the obvious threat in Spain, there was renewed talk. It is in this context that the Spanish Communist Party, small and isolated, made a shift on directives coming from Moscow. From their sectarian third period, where liberals were labeled social fascists, blurring the distinction between middle-class reformers and true Nazis. This, as many of us have learned, led elsewhere to fatal errors in the fight against fascism in Europe. Beginning in 1934, Stalin adopted a new line, swinging in the opposite direction to forge alliances with middle-class liberals, social democrats, or in Spain, Republicans. Popular frontism not only dropped any critique of reformist politics, but actually adopted the politics of reformism as its own. Stalin's shift underlined a fundamental change in the Communist International that aimed to convert the international proletariat into a vehicle of its own foreign policy, abandoning the objective of proletarian revolution. In the 1930s, with the looming relaunch of European war, Stalin's political objective was to gain an alliance with France and Britain to better defend himself from expansionist Nazi Germany. As we all know, Stalin could not very well appease those countries while also promoting international proletarian revolution. Stalin used the Stalin used the Popular Front to intervene with counter-revolutionary politics wherever possible. When we speak of the politics of the Popular Front, then, it is the politics of class collaboration. Workers defend social democracy, but this is a one-way street, so collaboration doesn't really fully explain the treachery. In Spain, though, workers may have felt they were doing the right thing, creating an electoral alliance to defeat the Spanish right. In reality, it was an electoral strategy dominated by the drive to contain revolutionary politics. Whatever their aim, the rank-and-file vote for the Republican-led Popular Front did not, in the minds of workers, equate to an illusion that bringing back the left Republicans and legislating reforms could improve the circumstances for workers, as many had believed in 1931. Nor did it mean they believed the Republicans could protect them from the oligarchy, now openly fascist and openly conspiring to overthrow democracy. What workers did expect with the Popular Front victory was to deliver a defeat to the right, earn back the jobs of all those sacked because of the 1934 general strike, and of course, free the political prisoners from that strike. In fact, workers didn't wait for the Popular Front to do much of anything. The defeat of the right at the polls with their votes sparked workers to take matters into their own hands. They stormed the prisons and freed many of the political prisoners from 1934 themselves. The massive Socialist Party, as promised, refused to participate in the government they had just contributed to electing, forced, as they were, to adapt to the radicalization of the socialist rank and file. Left Republican leader Manuel Azaña was pushed into the presidency of the Republic even before a change of government could be properly effective, in the hope of staving off the revolution by replacing the conservative Alcalá Zamora. Azaña, in turn, was pushed to ratify by decree the actions of the workers at the prison gates and in the fields where rural workers were seizing the land. With the Spanish ruling class reeling from electoral defeat and alarmed at the confidence of the working class, was exhibiting in the streets, fields, and workplaces, leaving bosses no chance but to hire back workers sacked over the previous 2 years of conservative government, Athanya could not risk calling in to challenge the workers, the same generals who were begging for martial law who were conspiring for a coup. In the spring of 1936, tens of thousands of farm laborers collectivized for their own benefit the lands they had worked and starved on for generations. To this revolutionary provocation, Athanya, again, rightfully distrustful of the military officers, was powerless. His only option was to legalize the collectives as a fait accompli. Between February and July 1936, social tensions grew hotter and hotter. Workers struck, bosses repressed. Overtly attempting to exacerbate social tensions, fascist gangs of the Falange and the Theta Youth roamed the late night streets, assassinating trade unionists and left-wingers. Provocations the workers answered in kind. Using the excuse of one such retaliation, the assassination of the monarchist MP, member of parliament, and known fascist provocateur José Calvo Sotelo by Republican and socialist policemen, on July 13th, Franco and the military began just a few days later their revolt. In truth, as we know, they had been conspiring since the first days of the Republic, but with special earnest after the Popular Front victory of February 1936. In Spain, fascism would take the form of a military rebellion that was supported by all the forces of reaction, which I won't list again, even though I do here. Though not all of the military joined the rebellion, leaving the Republican government without its repressive apparatus. Workers' organizations filled the vacuum left by the politically paralyzed Republicans. They organized militias and collectivized enormous sectors of the economy, not to save the Republican government, but instead to fight against fascism and in the process fundamentally reorganize society. So what went wrong? As we saw at the beginning of this talk, the Spanish working class filled the vacuum of power created by the paralysis of the Popular Front government faced with the rebellion of its armed forces. Filling that vacuum meant first stopping the military assault, which they did in many parts of the country, especially where the working class organizations were strongest and most concentrated, but not in conservative regions in Spain, and not so much in rural areas where the military had an easier time defending the more sparsely concentrated land workers. But where the military was defeated, power passed to the workers' organizations, especially to the CNT. In Catalonia, where the revolution was strongest, Catalan President Lluís Companys famously called the anarchists into his government palace and offered himself as their servant in the fight against fascism. Revolutionary power was already theirs in the street. Companys offered his offer was not sincere. He was gambling that the anarchists would remain true to their principles and refuse to take power since they were opposed to proletarian dictatorship. These are Companys' words to the anarchists. Today, you are the masters of the city and of Catalonia. You have conquered everything, and everything is in your power. If you do not need me or want me as president of Catalonia, I shall become just another soldier in the struggle against fascism. If, on the other hand, you believe in this post, I and the men of my party can be useful in this struggle. The anarchists chose not to take Companys up on his offer, a fatal mistake. This created a situation of dual power. Militant workers held effective power through their organizing of the defense and war effort and the wholesale collectivization of the economy. Yet the Generalitat, the Catalonian Republican government, and Spanish central government still existed, even if only in name in many parts. The story of the next year is a story of how the balance of forces was rejigged, power passing progressively and increasingly to the Republican governments and out of the hands of the Spanish and Catalan workers. This began with the creation in August of the Catalan Antifascist Militia Committee, which began to centralize all the committees and institutions of the revolution. While the anarchists dominated this committee, they allowed for representation from bourgeois parties as well as for representatives of the Generalitat. This was a move that gave the Generalitat legitimacy, effectively endorsed by the anarchists through their refusal to eliminate it. The Generalitat's representative, Josep Tarradellas, used his position to great advantage, accruing responsibilities away from the Antifascist Militia Committee and for the Generalitat, undermining workers' power. In August, the anarchists joined the Basque regional government, the Republican government. In September, the anarchists agreed to dissolve the Antifascist Committee and centralize the revolution through the Generalitat, which they joined as ministers. In November, the anarchists continued their march toward counter-revolution by joining the Spanish Republican government, the central government, which by this time was now in Valencia. Instead of creating an alternative to the capitalist government in July and August when they had a chance, the anarchists took a principled stance against workers' power because they opposed proletarian dictatorship. But power needed to be decentralized, and dual power as an inherently unstable political reality would be resolved for one side or the other. The Republicans understood this, but they also knew that they could not simply do away with the anarchists, since they still held effective political power on the streets, and they were armed. None of this was as easy as all that, though, as this brief description of the trajectory might suggest. The anarchist rank and file would not give up power easily. Two factors made it possible, ultimately, to defeat them. One, the Spanish government did its part in defeating the revolution in Catalonia and Aragon. Largo Caballero, the left socialist leader, was appointed first minister of the government. As we saw earlier, he was the left wing of the Socialist Party, and as prime minister, he offered a semblance of legitimacy to the central government, to radical workers. The Republicans also sabotaged the revolution. The central government sabotaged the revolution, even at the expense of losing the war to the fascists. And I'll give one example, which I think is really illustrative, and it's just one of many. The anarchists set about immediately to build a war industry to fight the fascists, who had taken much of the military and the hardware included, and were receiving aid, not to mention, from Hitler and Mussolini. And in the city of Toledo, near Madrid, there were three munition factories. The problem was, it looked like Toledo would not hold out for very long against the fascists. The anarchists, seeing this, offered to transport the factories back to safer grounds in Catalonia and rebuild and modernize them. However, the Republican government, not wanting to give the anarchists any more weapons, turned them down. Those factories were lost to the fascists within a few weeks. This is not an isolated example. The other significant factor in the counter-revolution was the rise of the communists. The Stalinist Spanish Communist Party and the Catalan Spanish Communist Party called the PASUK. There's a whole lot that I can't get into about how all that worked. We can talk about it in discussion. The communists were bolstered by the state, by the stature they gained from the arms they were able to get from Stalin at an exorbitant cost in gold. The Republicans were more than willing to facilitate the rise of the communists because they were both committed anti-revolutionaries and a left cover for counter-revolution. Furthermore, the communists helped to provide the ideological and bureaucratic edifice of the counter-revolution by trumpeting the call for unity, both in centralizing the economy as well as reestablishing a traditional hierarchical military structure to the alternative as an alternative to the militias. Of course, this they hoped and succeeded in doing by placing their own members in positions of power. The famous events of May 1937, known simply as Los Sucesos de Mayo, the May events, were critical in the ultimate defeat of the revolution, the moment when power finally passed more or less definitively from the anarchists and revolutionary workers of whatever stripe back to the Generalitat, who did much of the heavy lifting of the counter-revolution, and ultimately to the Spanish central government. In May, a Catalan police force led by the communists stormed the telephone exchange building, which had been held by the anarchists ever since the July uprising. The provocation was both symbolic, the elimination of an example of revolutionary power that still existed in the heart of Barcelona, but also important for strategic reasons. It was hard for the Republican government to maintain secret and counter-revolutionary conversations when the anarchists were listening in on the phone lines. The assault on the telephone exchange sparked a renewed show of force by Catalan workers, rebuilding the barricades from the previous year, this time to defend the revolution from the Catalan and Spanish central government. After several days of street fighting, anarchist leaders on behalf of the Popular Front government they now represented finally convinced the rank and file to put down the guns. There are two things left to say. First, much of the counter-revolution was possibly because of the role played by the Spanish Communist Party, which grew rapidly and massively with the outbreak of war. The PASUK didn't even exist until July 20 or 21st, after the beginning of the rebellion. Now I lost my place. They grew rapidly and massively with the outbreak of war, tellingly as the strongest opponents of collectivization and the revolutionary militias. They recruited government bureaucrats and predominantly anti-revolutionary members of the Spanish middle classes. Second, fascism could have been defeated in Spain. Opponents of the revolution always trumpet the apparent truism that only with broad unity could the fascists be defeated, but they forget to recall that the fact that broad unity was accomplished violently, and the war was lost. The war was lost because the Popular Front government was unwilling and incapable of waging a true war against fascism, a war that would have given a true stake for workers, a war that could have ignored the Popular Front and Stalinist fears of alienating the so-called democracies of Britain, France, and even the U.S., powers who, to a degree that they intervened at all, did so to the benefit of Franco and not the Republic. The lessons for socialists today, and I would argue the reason why we need to challenge the principles of anarchism, is that if we ever hope to achieve a socialist revolution or libertarian communism, we have to build organizations and parties that aim to replace the capitalist state, whatever permutation that might be, with workers' power. As the Friends of Durruti, the small group of anarchists, CNT anarchists in Spain that learned the lessons of the Civil War and made a last-ditch effort to correct their mistakes, said, "We, the CNT, did not have a concrete program. We had no idea where we were going. We had lyricism aplenty, but it all said and done, we did not know what to do with our masses of workers or how to give effect to the popular effusion." And they went on, "To beat Franco, we needed to crush the bourgeoisie and its Stalinist and socialist allies. The capitalist state must be destroyed totally, and there must be installed workers' power, depending on rank and file workers' committees. Apolitical anarchism has failed." Irish anarchist Eddie Conlon wouldn't necessarily agree with all that, but wrote recently about the Friends of Durruti. "During the May Days," this is Eddie Conlon, "during the May Days, they called for the setting up of a revolutionary junta. They called for the disarming of the police, the socialization of the economy, the dissolving of the political parties that had turned against the working class. In effect, they called for workers' power." True, and I couldn't agree more.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.